place. It is a complete vacation destination where guests may stay as long as they like. And here, even a hotel is an adventure.
And now our national anthem.
Kids, oh, sing like the birds sing. Tweet, 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 tweet.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stitch has left the planet.
WDW Radio,
your information station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your Walt Disney World Information Station. I am your host, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 310 for the week of January 27th, 2013. I'm here to help you have the best possible Disney vacation experience and bring you a little bit of Disney magic to wherever you are by talking about the things that make us happy about Walt Disney World on this podcast, as well as my videos, blog, live broadcast, events, my Walt Disney World trivia books, audio tour CDs, and much more. You can find everything over at wdwradio.com. So this week, I want to help you enjoy and appreciate more of Walt Disney World's hidden treasures, not just in the parks, but in the resorts as well, because each is so replete with story, details, overlooked experiences, and fascinating history, often both real and imagineered. So join me as we virtually tour and explore the lobby and lounge of Disney's Boardwalk Resort. You'll learn about the inspiration for the resort and the significance behind some of the wonderful props, replicas, and real antiques that are found throughout the hotel. Jim Corcus joins me on a journey that will take us to the boardwalks of Atlantic City and Coney Island from many years ago to the one that was recreated at one of our favorite Disney resorts. I'll then have the answer to our last Walt Disney World trivia question of the week and pose a new challenge for your chance to win a Disney prize package. I'll then have some announcements at the end of the show, including more details about our six-year anniversary show and how you can help decide what we do and when. We'll talk more about our WDW Radio On the Road events, including our group trip to Disney's Aulana Resort in Hawaii, cruise on the Disney Fantasy, and upcoming events at the Walt Disney Family Museum and elsewhere around the country. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show. Throughout Walt Disney World, I love being able to show you some of the details and the stories. And what you need to realize is that they don't just exist inside the theme parks and in the attractions. It's really in everything that we experience. And in fact, the resorts, I think, are sort of hidden treasures of themselves, from the theming and the stories and the dining and the entertainment opportunities that are there. But the real treasures throughout a lot of these resorts lie in the details, which are often overlooked. I think every resort has so many wonderful details and stories throughout. And today, we're going to look at one of those resorts and some of those incredible details, because this one literally sort of hits home. It's close to home for me because I grew up and spent my first 40 years of life on this planet in New Jersey. And I spent many of my summers on the Jersey Shore, on the beaches, and on the boardwalk of Atlantic City. So this week, we're going to visit and explore the details and some of those hidden treasures inside Disney's Boardwalk Resort. And today, I'm once again joined by a man who loves a good saltwater taffy, a Miss America pageant, and the Penny Arcade Machines. He is Jim Corcus, the author of the revised Vault of Walt and Who's Afraid, A Song of the South.
Well, thank you so much. It's always a joy to be with Snooki Mangiello at the Jersey Shore here. But the situation is, as they say, a lot of the wonderful details at the resorts are overlooked because it's seamless. It's that seamless Disney storytelling. They're so right that we don't pay attention to them. They don't stand out. They blend in with the story that is being told. And As you alluded to, I think one of the things that's a Disney difference is that in the Disney resort hotels, they really do it just so wonderfully in terms of a theme. It's not just laying on a bunch of things. There's a story behind all of that, and I'm glad we're going above our pay scale today and visiting the Boardwalk Inn and Villas here. So thanks for inviting me today. It's always a joy to talk with you and to share this and with the listeners as well. I know that many of you write in and you just love the stuff that Lou and I share. But if you have something else to add, if you have another piece of the puzzle, if you grew up in Atlantic City, or you had a parent or a grandparent who told you stories about Atlantic City or Coney Island, please make sure you send in the comments so that Lou and I look a lot smarter the next time we talk about this.
Well, what I like about the Boardwalk, you know, look, when you visit the Disney World resorts, it very much is a transformative experience, right? You walk through you walk into the lobby of Wilderness Lodge, you are in the Pacific Northwest, you walk into Kidani Village or Jumbo House, you feel as though you are in a hotel that you'd find in Africa. But here at the Boardwalk, I think more so probably than anywhere else, unless you grew up in Tahiti, this is where you may actually get a sense of a place that you had visited, a place that whether you vacation there or for me was a place I sort of called home because I did spend so many summers there. And as you walk around, you see things that in true Disney fashion really not just reflect a time and a place and a location, but almost are sort of pulled from the postcards and brought here.
Absolutely. And Lou, as old as I am, I'm old as dirt. I get reminded of that every day when I look in the mirror. I have this real yearning and longing for these time periods that were before I was born, you know, and here, especially at the Boardwalk, capturing the 1920s and the 1930s, it's just so comforting. It's just so healing. And again, just done so well with such quality, with such attention to detail. And you're right. You know, the moment you walk into some place like the Wilderness Lodge, it just takes your breath away. No matter how many times you've been there, you're just overwhelmed. And here at the Boardwalk, you know, as soon as you walk into the lobby over there on the left-hand side, just like any good storyteller, Disney is foreshadowing the story that you're going to be told. So you have an authentic Ballyhoo banner up there, and then you have this little area underneath where you have images of the story that they're going to tell about the diving horse, you know, at the Steel Pier, and Lucy the elephant, and gosh, the first Miss America, and the wonderful shops on the Boardwalk itself, and you're already taken away, and they have a greeter in the appropriate costume outside and all of that, and so now you're stepping back really into the era of the Boardwalk Empire. But the Boardwalk Empire, of course, concentrates on some of those more rowdy aspects like gambling and prostitution and speakeasies and all of that, which were very much a part of the flavor of the 20s and 30s in Atlantic City and Coney Island. But there was so much more. It really was a hub of entertainment, a lot of wonderful musicians and performers were in Atlantic City. There was, in fact, at the time, it was described as a vacation in itself. And what always makes me smile is that nowadays, that's what Walt Disney World has become itself. Walt Disney World is the Atlantic City or the Coney Island for a whole new century.
Well, and if you look, I'm sure you remember back in the 1870s when that's what Atlantic City was. It was pre-Boardwalk when it was – and look, if you visit Atlantic City now and you visit during the day, you drive around and you can still see remnants of some of those beautiful, like elegant hotels from the mid-1800s. But it isn't until 1870 that the idea for this boardwalk to really sort of take advantage of the summer season but not let people be traipsing sand in and out of the hotels – this idea of this temporary summer boardwalk comes to pass and obviously eventually becomes a much grander, much more permanent fixture.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize that the Atlantic City Boardwalk was the very first boardwalk in the United States. And again, as you alluded to, businesses, hotels didn't want people running around on the beach and then traipsing the beach, you know, into the hotels, into the businesses. Same thing that Walt Disney ran into when he picked Walt Disney World. He did not want to build near the beach just to avoid those same problems. And that first boardwalk was roughly about 6 feet wide and about a mile long. And it wasn't just there to prevent people from bringing in sand. Sometimes people would go off on that vacation and they'd love the sea air and they'd love the view, but they don't want to set foot in filthy nature there, you know, because these are elegant men and women and ones who could afford to take a vacation because people couldn't in those days. And there weren't many places to go, but you would come out. And of course, eventually the boardwalk expanded so that it was about 65 feet wide, maybe 80 feet wide, and went on for 6 miles or more, and just absolutely incredible. And then again, you had people who didn't want to play in the sand, so a clever entrepreneur would rent wheelchairs. So the rich people could sit in wheelchairs and be wheeled along the boardwalk to look out and see all of that.
Which they had. I remember as a kid going to Atlantic City, and they still have those sort of wicker wheelchairs where you can sort of ride up and down. It was more of an attraction than it was a conveyance, but obviously the boardwalk had gotten so much bigger with the casinos as well. So it did make sense to inspire a themed resort like this. It was designed by Robert Stern, who also designed the Yacht and Beach Club across the way. Very, very complementary of one another. You talked about this before about Stern's sort of interpretive design of architecture, taking something like the Northeast Atlantic Seaside Resort or a yacht-themed resort or even something like the Boardwalk and adding not just a lot of reality but his own little spin on it as well.
Absolutely. In fact, that's Robert Stern's philosophy is interpretation when it comes to design as an architect, that you take something that's already existing, but you interpret that for a new generation. So you're not doing an exact historical recreation, but you're using some specific elements to almost create a cinematic feel. So you're mixing history and cinema to create that almost fuzzy memory of, yes, this seems right. This must be the way it was. I've seen this in the movies of looking at that. And very much used elements from the Atlantic City boardwalk from the 20s and 30s. Also from Coney Island, specifically Luna Park, which was an upscale amusement park. When people talk about Coney Island and Coney Island Amusement Park, a lot of people don't realize it was three separate parks. It was Steeplechase Park was the first park, and that really had the theme rides and exciting thrill rides, too. Steeplechase was a gravity roller coaster where you sat on steel horses and they went up and down. And then next to it was Luna Park, which was more affluent. And it was the Electric Eden. There were thousands of electric lights, and that was a novelty in those days. And they had even foreign pavilions, you know, for Japan and Ireland, all that. And then Dreamland, which was more of a had more kiddie park rides type of thing. So Luna Park was an inspiration. But also, believe it or not, Cape May was an inspiration, which, of course, themes into Yacht and Beach Club over there, that those same type of designs. And what's wonderful is how seamlessly all of those elements are blended in to this physical location.
Right. So when it opens in July of 96, it's not just the second Disney Vacation Club resort, but it really opens up as more than just a hotel. It opens up as sort of an entertainment complex, because what the boardwalk now provides is a place to do as they did in the 20s and 30s. You wander on the promenade, you window shop, you eat. There's entertainers, there's boardwalk-style games. And you hear from people sometimes, well, this isn't what the Atlantic City Boardwalk actually looks like, but that's what Disney does. Whether you go to Adventureland or Animal Kingdom Lodge, you're not pulling out a specific location from an image or a postcard. You're pulling in a representation of what the boardwalk was like. And as somebody who walked on the Atlantic City Boardwalk, you do sort of get that same kind of feel. And when you see the street, you know, the boardwalk musicians and the jugglers and the storefronts, you very much get, if you've been there before, you very much get a very authentic feel.
And of course, it's a lot safer than the real boardwalk. It's a lot cleaner than the you run into a better class of people sometimes. And
I was going to say the food is better here too, but then again, there's some things you can't get here that you can still get in Atlantic City.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. I think one of the things that makes this unique as a Disney resort are those restaurants. The shops, the entertainment that is taking place. And yes, not only the second Disney Vacation Club property opened, the first was Old Key West, of course, but it was the first Disney Vacation property that was mixed use. So you have the the Boardwalk Inn, where regular people can stay, and then the Boardwalk Villas, where Disney Vacation Club members stay. And again, both of those blend together seamlessly, although each section has its own personality. And yes, the Boardwalk was going to be much more elaborate than it even was when it opened in 96. One of the things that had been planned and discussed was a full-size carousel on the boardwalk, which I would have loved to have seen. They were also planning for a Ferris wheel that was going to be out in Crescent Lake. So you would walk out on the boardwalk and then out there on a ramp out to the Ferris wheel, and it would be lit up at night. I would have loved to have seen that with fireworks. There were plans for, just like the Hoop-Dee-Doo review at Fort Wilderness, there were plans that there was going to be a live-action upscale show here at the Boardwalk. As some of you may be familiar about one of the best-kept secrets of the Boardwalk, is there's an area called the Attic. It's right above Jelly Rolls, and it's called an attic because there's an awful lot of artifacts in there, so it looks like a turn-of-the-century attic or an attic into the 1920s. And they were going to have a show in there that was called Walt's Attic. So you were going to have music and entertainment. So it wasn't going to be – it wouldn't be a down-home, slap-your-knee, hoop-dee-doo show. It would be in keeping with the personality of the boardwalk. It would be more upscale, maybe along the lines of what the old Top of the World show was at the top of the Contemporary. So, yes, as affluent and overwhelming as this resort was, there were plans to make it even larger.
And I remember when there was discussion about that, excuse me, and, you know, whether all of a sudden you now have a, you know, do you want that kind of a carnival-type atmosphere in this area when you have Epcot Center, mm-hmm. a stone's throw away, and Hollywood Studios right down the lake, right down the walkway, is this what this was supposed to be like? Would it take away from the resorts? Would it take away from how placid and quiet it is here for the most part? And I love that you mentioned Walt's attic, the attic, because when you talk about a hidden treasure of this resort, it's actually one of my favorite locations. If you're staying here in the villas, and you walk, it's a long hike down there. If they had a rolling cart that would take you, it would be much easier. But it is one of the most serene, beautiful, one of the most beautiful vistas of Crescent Lake and the boardwalk that you can find. And on a nice day, to be able to sit up there with a drink, a cup of coffee, a newspaper, or your iPad, whatever it may be, it really is. You talk about that when people went on vacations, that's what they did. They sat, they played games, they read the paper, they just spent time together. That's what I think the attic really embodies. And it's also a venue. So if you want to have an event here, I actually had my wife's 40th birthday party, surprise birthday up there. It's a great place for a small, intimate gathering like that, a rehearsal dinner, etc.
Well, obviously you won't be able to go home tonight since you revealed it's 40th.
I mean, her 40th birthday is coming many, many years in the future. She's actually celebrating, I think, the 20th anniversary of her 40th birthday. So.
And yes, they've held weddings there, and I've spoken to different convention groups up there. In fact, that was the first time I found out that there was a place called the Attic. They said, well, you're going over to the boardwalk to speak. And I was used to going to different resorts, and they had convention rooms and all that. And they said, oh, and you'll be speaking in the Attic. And I go, what the heck is that? What is all that? But Lou is absolutely right. Absolutely beautiful. And again, if you're staying at the resort, you could probably go to the registration desk and ask, and someone might take you up there and let you go in and take a peek. But yes, we're actually talking right now in the Bellevue Lounge, and as Lou mentioned earlier, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, you have to realize there was no TV, there was no electronic device with apps, there was no iPad and iTunes and all of that. If you weren't out playing on the beach or at the amusement park, what did you do with the rest of your time when you were on vacation? Well, you would usually be in a nice sitting room like this, or almost like a parlor, and what you would do is you'd be playing board games, and there are a lot of board games in here. Lou and I were in here taking a look at some. There's Go to the Head of the Class, which came out in 1936, and it's sort of an early version of Trivial Pursuit, where it's a classroom and there's desks, and you start at the back of the class, and by answering questions in science and geography and whatever, you move up, you know, on the desk towards the front, and there's cards.
Just what kids want to do on vacation is play a game where it brings them back to school.
Yeah, well, again, you don't take kids on vacation. What kind of vacation is that? Don't take your kids on vacation. You want to be a kid yourself. And there'd also be cards like, you know, put away that pea shooter, go back two desks, or you have wonderful penmanship, you know, move ahead. And I don't know if anybody has wonderful penmanship anymore, cursive. Lou and I this last weekend helped do some Disney history presentations for a wonderful group from Buena Vista University in Storm Lake City, Iowa. And one of them, who is 20, said, the teacher wanted me to write this out. And I said, why do I have to write it out? I'm never going to use cursive. I'm never going to use cursive in my life.
My 7-year-old son is doing penmanship now, and he said the same thing. He says, Daddy, everybody types everything. Why do I need to write?
Yes.
I said, you're right, kid. Just get the homework done.
And there are other games like Tell It to the Judge, which was you'll see when you come in. They have it out on display. Again, 1936 game, and Eddie Cantor, banjo-wise. Again, a very, very popular entertainer, completely forgotten today. And what's fascinating about this game, board game, is you start with your car in your garage, and you're going to the nightclub. But as you curve around, you're going to run into all sorts of problems, like a flat tire or running a red light, and you're going to have to go tell it to the judge, you know, to get out of that, to keep moving ahead to do that. But Lou, there's a very famous board game, isn't there, connected with this resort?
Yeah, fun times in the 30s. So you could either play a game where you went back to school and got in trouble, got in your car and had to go to the police, or nobody likes anything more than buying and selling property. That's the pinnacle of excitement, but it was back in the early 30s when Charles Darrow came up with this idea for a game called Monopoly, which was about buying and selling property, a game that he was unable to sell to Parker Brothers. They wanted nothing to do with it, so what does he do? I love the entrepreneurial spirit. He hand makes 5,000 of them. Actually, there was a fascinating documentary on CNBC about the history of Monopoly showing how these were made by hand. And actually, the original board was not a square, but it was a circle, sort of a hub and a spoke that you sort of went around in a circle. And as we were saying, he eventually sold it to Parker. He sold 5,000 the first year. He sells it to Parker Brothers next year, and they're selling, you know, 20,000 a year. They can't keep them on the shelves. But it sort of perfectly fits in, obviously, because the idea of Monopoly came from the streets of Atlantic City, this glamorous, very prestigious, very upscale sort of vacation place. He wanted to bring that to sort of that post-Depression era.
Right. Places like Reading Railroad, the Short Line, all of those were in Atlantic City. And, of course, you know, the prime piece of property, the boardwalk, to do that. But, Lou, we were talking about this and the documentary that you saw. There was actually a mistake on the original Monopoly game because, of course, Darrow was doing this by hand. Maybe it was in cursive. Maybe that's where the mistake came from. There was a mistake on the game that lasted for decades. Parker Brothers apologized for it just a couple of years ago. What was that mistake on the Monopoly game, Lou?
So, it was a Jim Corcus moment. I never realized that Marvin Gardens was spelled incorrectly.
Right. On the game, it was spelled with an I, but in Atlantic City, it was spelled with an E. So that's how popular Atlantic City was, that you have an entire game based on it. And how many generations have played that game and not realized that it related to that? Also in the Bellevue Lounge, you'll see an awful lot of radios from the 30s. These are authentic radios. At least the exterior facade is authentic. The interiors have gone through some rewiring because during parts of the day you can sit here in the Bellevue Lounge and you can hear radio shows from the 30s and the 40s, something I just absolutely love.
It's one of those sort of unexpected hidden treasures, I think, of the Bellevue Lounge, which is actually one of my favorite places just to sort of sit with friends and get away. There's a bar here. There's no food like a lot of the other lounges. This is what sort of makes this one unique. But it is a great place whether you want an iced tea or something more adult-oriented. And if you come here during the holidays, the broadcasts change as well, too. They're holiday-themed broadcasts, again, that are authentic to the period.
And there's all sorts of authentic memorabilia in here, too. A Brownie camera, a magic lantern. There's little games. There's a Stereopticon up on an upper shelf, you know. Again, I wish I could just take some of those things home with me. But Walt Disney Imagineering had an outside company look and obtain many of those artifacts for here. But again, once again, because they are so real to that time period, people just bypass them. You know, even taking a look at the books on the shelves, you see that, of course, they are books that were popular and published during the 20s and the 30s. They don't go beyond that. I know that on some websites they talk about the boardwalk being turn of the century, and there's some turn of the century elements, but what it is it's the 1920s, and those things are still around from the turn of the century. It isn't the turn of the century. I've heard some websites go, oh, well, it's the 40s. Well, it was the 40s. We'd have elements of the war, and we don't. This is one of those very comfortable periods. Of course, it's the Great Depression, but it's not happening here in Atlantic City.
Yeah, I think the Bellevue Lounge really is such a wonderful snapshot in time from the period. It's things that you would have seen, even from the sconces and the chandeliers and the furniture, that sort of wicker with the plaid cushions on it. It's a snapshot in time from the early, you know, from the Northeast Atlantic, from this Atlantic city sort of era. But Jim, I think that really goes to the idea of it's not just about individual details that are put together. It's about the connecting the dots, the cohesiveness of the story that I think happens in sort of multiple chapters. Like you say, when you sort of walk into that lobby, look, when you approach and you see the white popcorn lights on the sign that says Boardwalk and you walk into that lobby, the story is already being told. It's being set for you. And as soon as you pass through that entranceway, the first thing that we see really helps to sort of bring it all together. And it's this incredibly beautiful, detailed, authentic miniature carousel.
Yes. And not just a miniature carousel, an authentic miniature carousel, and a authentic miniature carousel done by Marcus Charles, and Ilions. I'm going to hope I pronounced that last name correctly. And his nickname, by the way, was Mike. So sometimes you'll see Mike Ilions out there. That was
Millions. They just call him Millions.
Yeah, well, because and again, because he was an immigrant, and you want to get, you know, an Americanized name. And he was he is still considered today one of the two master carvers of carousels, and especially carousel horses. And in fact, he actually worked for the master carver before he went off and started on his own. And he was a master horseman. He owned several horses of his own. So he was very intimately knowledgeable about equine anatomy and even facial veins, things like this. So his horses just seemed so alive and just, you know, reached out. What happened is carousel started to fall out of favor for a while, and also there were mass production techniques that came in, and MC just would not put up with that. So he started his own company and proposed to create Supreme Carousels. But in order to sell people on that idea, he came up with this model, this miniature model, and he hand-carved each of the horses. There are 44 horses on this. All of them are 4 inches tall. All of them hand-carved. None of them identical. So they're each unique. And he's putting this together as a sales tool that he can take out because it actually works. The horses go up and down and all this. So he can take and he can convince people that they should invest in building these Supreme Carousels. Three Supreme Carousels were built. None of them exist today simply because individual parts of a carousel are more valuable than the carousel as a whole. And so an individual carousel horse can easily sell for $500,000 or more. But this was not meant. This little miniature was never meant to be seen by the public. It was just a little sales device, and that he took around to get investors, and it was locked away for 80 years. Until the Disney company bought it in 1995.
And, you know, we can't stress enough, you know, when you think about something that's created as a sales tool, you think that it's sort of a small-scale mock-up of something just to illustrate maybe the mechanics of the carousel. I'll take a couple of pictures, but, Jim, I can't stress enough that people need to come and see just how detailed this really is. And obviously, when Imagineering purchased it, they don't just restore it to the way it originally looked. They go through painstaking research, as they always do, to make sure that the colors are authentic, that the saddles are made of real leather, the little stirrups are made of leather. They recreate the sort of pinhead light bulbs, you know, hundreds and hundreds around there. They add brass. There's gold leaf. They make sure the speed of the carousel is authentic, so much so that it matches the speed, if it was real size, of King Arthur Carousel in Disneyland. But it truly is a work of art. I mean, it's something that we are grateful that was rescued from obscurity or destruction.
And again, what I've always said is when the Disney Company does something right, they really do it right. And you were pointing out the intensive restoration that they did. It took over a year because they literally went out and looked at carousels that MC had worked on to take a look at color schemes. You know, what type of colors did he use and how did this blend this way and all of that, because you know, to incorporate into this and yes, the replating of the brass, the gold leaf, the attention to detail. So this is just magnificent. This is the way that it would have looked when he was showing it around, roughly around 1912, 1915 is the guess on this, except with one major difference. What they did with that wonderful sense of humor that Disney has, if you take a look at the blue and green chariot, the chariot is the little bench area that people could sit on rather than ride a horse. If you look up about two horses ahead of that chariot on the outer ring, there's a horse and he is covered with hidden Mickeys. I don't know if you could really call them hidden Mickeys because you can see them so clearly. You won't miss them. But if you really want to be challenged, there's another horse with those same hidden Mickeys that's on an inner ring that's further away from that. But yes, beautifully done. It still operates. And so every 20 to 23 minutes or so, it'll go, and the horses actually go up and down. Now, the music you hear will not be music from the 20s and 30s. You'll actually hear Disney music, which I think is completely appropriate. And talking about Disney doing things right, just in case you don't happen to have Lou and I around with you and you're trying to remember all of this information, some of this information is on a nice little white plaque that they have on a pillar next to the carousel there.
Yeah, and as you said, I think the most fascinating thing about the carousel is not just the true craftsmanship that was put into it, but the fact that it still works. 100 years later, it still works. And again, I think you need to sort of see it to really appreciate it. But, you know, beyond that, Jim, when you walk in, and I say this all the time, especially in Walt Disney World, we're trained as we walk into a place, we look around, we look down, we look at some of the details we see. So often we never look up. There are people I take through Magic Kingdom all the time that I'll walk into the expansion of the Emporium where East Center Street, West Center Street used to be, and I have them look up and nobody realizes that gigantic, beautiful, elegant chandelier that sits there. I think here too, you need to take a moment as you walk in and look up at the Hippocampus Electrolier chandelier. You can't miss it. It may be the biggest chandelier literally on the planet.
Yeah, you also mentioned that isn't it amazing that after 100 years that I'm hoping after 100 years I'll still work as well as that little miniature carousel. Yeah, Hippocampus, and for those of you who are not paying attention in school, Hippocampus is actually from Greek mythology. And it was a sea monster type creature where the front of it was a horse, and the back end was fish-like, a fish tail, whatever. Quite literally, a sea horse. And, of course, the hippocampus was what would pull the chariot for Poseidon. And, in fact, there's a lot of Poseidon statues that will have a hippocampus with it. And for those of you who are into the medical range, hippocampus is actually part of your brain. But it's in a shape that looks like the normal seahorse that we see. So, see, Mom and Dad, you should let kids listen to Lou's podcast because this is the way they should be getting their education.
We say this all the time. There are so many educational opportunities here at Walt Disney World. This is how I justified my parents pulling me out of school.
And, yeah, it weighs 3,000 pounds. It's covered in 22-carat gold leaf. It has Austrian crystal on it. You've got some cupids on there. And again, this is very much in the style of MC and what would... you know, what would be on carousels or in amusement parks like Coney Island. And Lou, do you know why it's called an electrolier?
Right, because weren't the electroliers, they were designed for the electric lamps as opposed to candles or gas bulbs?
Absolutely. So electrolier is synonymous with basically what we know today as chandeliers. And it was a name that was used that just didn't catch on. And my understanding is that it was Thomas Edison who came up with the name because, again, he was trying to promote electricity. But, you know, you can call something whatever you want to call it. People will still call it what they want to call it.
Yeah, and the thing that's – look, it's magnificent and it's beautiful. But what I love about this too is that for many years, and we realize it's not the way it is now – there was also literally a piece of Walt Disney World history, again, literally attached to the hippocampus chandelier. Because if you look on the bottom, there is a crystal globe that's hanging from there, sort of with a gold finial on the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. It's empty now, but at one point it was actually a time capsule. It was filled with sand and elements that were put in there that were meant to be open for Walt Disney World's 50th anniversary, which, believe it or not, is coming up faster than I can imagine. But there was a problem with the globe, whether it leaked or it broke, whatever it may be. The globe now sits empty, and like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm sure the time capsule is somewhere safe in a giant warehouse somewhere.
A long way. So many other treasures. Yes, we both Lou and I have gotten contradictory explanations, but the bottom line is something was wrong with the globe, and so the time capsule had to be saved and preserved elsewhere. But there is a globe underneath that now. And you know, we jumped ahead to the... that area with the carousel along the way. I hope you guys stopped in the restroom because between the two restrooms is a casting from a sculpture that MC Illions did that would have been on a carousel in between the mirrors. And so this is a fiberglass casting, but it was hand painted, but it was cast from an actual 1910 element from a carousel, and then right directly across from that is my baby Lou. You know what I'm talking about, right?
You know, he looks just like his father too. Yeah, because as you start to, when you walk into the lobby, and we'll talk a little bit more about what's on the left hand side as well, but if you start walking to the right. Towards the hotel side and where the Bellevue Lounge is. And we noticed how many people walked by.
Right.
All the things that we're talking about. But across from the restrooms on the left-hand side, you can look out over the courtyard and the promenade overlooking Crescent Lake. But you can also see there a mutoscope, a clamshell mutoscope, but one of two that used to be here. And many of us who... And we shed a silent tear when we think about the Penny Arcade on Main Street, USA. Remember those from originally being on Main Street. But you have a great story about sort of how that clamshell mutoscope went from Main Street, USA, eventually here.
And you're just going to make me cry again, Lou. You're going to make me cry again, but that's okay. I'll do that because you're a friend, and people need to know. The world needs to know. I need to let people know this. The Penny Arcade on Main Street at Walt Disney World closed in 1995, and I personally feel that is a tremendous loss, and especially because many of the items in the Penny Arcade were authentic. Some came from the Disneyland collection. When Magic Kingdom opened in 71, they got some from there, but Walt Disney World bought some of their own as well. These were all authentic, working pieces, whether it was the orchestron, which is the music boxes, or the mutoscopes, or some of the arcade games, or to see how strong you are, or the love tester, or whatever those things were. So 1995, that closed. In 1996, I had been working at Magic Kingdom as a friend of Merlin the Magician, and in 1996, I'd been hired as an animation instructor at the brand new Disney Institute that was going to be opening shortly. And one of the classes that I had to create for the Disney Institute was called Animated Beginnings. Maybe some of you listening took that class, and it was the history of animation. And so I would teach guests how to make a thaumatrope, which is that round circle which has an image on one side like a bird, and on the other side it has a cage. And then when you twist it back and forth, the two images blend together, so you have a bird in a cage. I taught guests how to do zoetrope strips, all of that. But I went to my manager and I said, you know, they've closed the Penny Arcade. What did they do with the mutoscope machines? Maybe this would be a good thing to have over in the classroom. And of course, since the Disney Institute was just being built, when something is just being built, somehow there always seems to be money. After it opens, there's no money at all. But right before it opens, it seems like people are, you can get money from some budget somewhere or whatever. And so my manager, Larry Laurie, and I called around and we made connections because, again, Disney is different departments, different divisions. So you have to buy from another division something. And so it was determined that, yes, they were storing the mutoscopes, although eventually they would sell those off. They were storing them, and so I went underneath the utilidors. And I'd been through the utilidors before because I had worked at Magic Kingdom, but this was a section of the utilidor that I was completely unfamiliar with. And there was this one guy, and he was the one guy who was in charge of all of the devices, the mutoscopes and the music boxes, and only one guy. And after they closed the Penny Arcade, he went to work on the parade floats. And so he opened this door into this little dingy room that I didn't even know was there, and it was leaking because it was underneath the moat. And so here are all of these beautiful mutoscopes, some of them metal, some of them wood, whatever, and it was like somebody's messy attic. Things had been piled on top of each other or shoved at the side or whatever, and there was an unlocked cabinet that was halfway open. And so he and I went through looking to try and get ones that were in the best shape. So we got one that was painted green, one that was painted red. And he says, "And what do you want these things for?" And I said, "Well, we're teaching animation and all that." And he says, "Well, we don't have a lot of, you know, animation rolls. They're like a Rolodex roll." And he says, "You know, usually people wanted to see the live action stuff." And I said, "Well, even if you got the live action stuff, we can explain persistence of vision, all of this." He says, No, wait a second." So he opens up this cabinet. And it's piled with paper, and it's piled with some of these rolls and things like this. And he reaches in the back, and he pulls out this paper box, and he opens the paper box, and in there is this pristine roll, all these 850 opaque cards, and it's Felix the Cat. Felix the Cat. Because Felix the Cat was a silent movie star, and this was a section of a Felix the Cat cartoon from 1919. And you know why Felix is important in Disney history, right, Lou?
You know, by the way, first of all, you know that the only people that recognize the name Felix the Cat are you, I, and like one other person. But for a time, Felix the Cat was very popular. But yeah, you sort of enlightened me as sort of the Felix the Cat Disney connection.
Yeah, and again, Felix the Cat was the most popular cartoon character before Mickey Mouse made the scene. And he was in a lot of silent cartoons, and he was owned by Pat Sullivan. Pat Sullivan was doing this. And as I was explaining to Lou, the Disney connection is that the Felix the Cat cartoons were being distributed by Margaret Winkler. And Margaret Winkler, the reason she bought the Alice comedies from Walt Disney, You know, and that's how Walt Disney started in animation, was not with Oswald, not with Mickey, but with the Alice comedies. And he sold it to, in October 1923, sold the series to Margaret Winkler. The reason she wanted Walt Disney was not because he was such a great artist, not because it was such a great idea to combine a little girl with animation, but because she was distributing the Felix the Cat cartoons, and Pat Sullivan wanted more money. And so she wanted some leverage in case Pat Sullivan, you know, jumped ship and went and took Felix the Cat somewhere else. So she bought the Alice comedies, but she insisted that Walt put in a black cat into the Alice comedies. That's where Julius the Cat comes from. So in case Pat Sullivan leaves, by golly, she's got an animated cartoon series she can sell that's got this black cat that can do all of these crazy things. Well, things worked out with Pat Sullivan until Margaret Winkler married Charles Mintz, and not only did he upset Walt Disney, he upset Pat Sullivan. So that's a whole nother story. But thanks to Felix the Cat, we got Walt Disney into animation. So anyway, I'm looking at this 1919, and it's, oh my gosh, it's just beautiful. And he says, yeah, and I think we got a card here somewhere we can stick in there, and we'll look for something else. And so we're digging through, and some of these rolls are falling apart and things like this. But he found another silent animation card, and again, even in those days, I was unable to identify the particular cartoon because there were hundreds of these made. Most of them don't exist anymore. Most of them were not familiar characters because, again, they were just a trick film. Just, you know, we'll run it for a couple of weeks. We'll run it around the country, and then it's gone. It won't have any more use. So we got those, and we brought them over, and he showed me how to fix the mutoscope, because he was the only guy who could do it. There was only one key to open the mutoscope. And so there was only one key he could give me to use for both of these mutoscope here. So opened it up, and what he had done is he had jerry-rigged. He had taken a paper clip, and he had unbent it, and he had hooked it around. And he says, and so over here with it, because they didn't make parts for mutoscopes anymore. And there's the little metal coin box, and it was a small thing. And he says, so you got to change this out, because if it clogs up, then it's does this, and it'll stop this, and, you know, the hand crank won't go. Oh, my gosh, okay. So anyway, took these over, and so for a couple of years, they were over there at the Disney Institute in the classroom. We had to have a bowl of pennies out there because guests just went crazy wanting to put those in and go through. And on the crank, you've got to crank it one way. If you stop, or if you try to crank it in reverse, the light will go off or it'll stop, because you're creating a tension with the cards going through this. And then the Disney Institute just kept getting smaller and smaller. At one point, the animation classes were being done over in the culinary classroom. So the mutoscopes were moved over there, because they also had a design studio that they could reconfigure, you know, for animation. And then, of course, when the Disney Institute became so successful that it could not be in one particular location and closed down where now Saratoga Springs are, the mutoscopes just disappeared. And I thought, Jim, how foolish you are that you are so honest. You at any time, you could have just slid that into the back seat of your car and taken it home and cared for it and brought it up to puberty, you know, because it's over 100 years old, for crying out loud. And Then one day I was over here at the boardwalk, and I walked, and there's my two babies. There's the green one. There's the red one. Cat in a bag, Felix cat. And I put in the penny, and the thing just wouldn't move. The crank would move, and it's plugged in and all that. And I put in the penny, and I said, oh, I can fix this. And I reach, I don't have the key anymore. I can't open this up. But that is here now. My baby is here, and it survives. And this is a mutoscope from the that was made sometime between the 1880s and 1920. And the reason I know that is if you take a look at the metal in scripture on there. You'll see it's from the American Mutoscope Company, and they only made mutoscopes up until the mid-20s. And then in 26, I believe it was, from 26 to 49, it was the International Mutoscope Company. So here's something that is, you know, oh my gosh, you know, 100 years old, and this really still works, come on. But people just walking right by it. But they used to have that, and they also used to have, I think they used to have another one, which was, and your listeners will tell me whether I'm right or wrong. There was one that was white and had gold detailing, but I could tell that the interior had been gutted. This one, I looked in again today, and I know where to look, and I could see the light bulb is still
in
there.
It wants to work. You can tell it's close. It wants to work.
It says, Jim, Jim. Fix me, Jim. But again, I'm glad it's here. I'm glad it's inside. I'm glad it's not in a little dripping room. This is a memory. And I know that this one also came from Disneyland, because the guy who did this pointed out, you know, which ones had come from Disneyland's Penny Arcade, because Disneyland had bought more than they needed. So, this is actually a mutoscope that was in Disneyland in 1955, and then moved out to Magic Kingdom in 71, and then over to the Disney Institute, and now it's over here at the Boardwalk. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, you look sad. You look like you're feeling a little weak. You need a little bit of help. So if you walk a little bit farther down the hallway by where the elevator bank are, mm-hmm. you can go use – well, you if you were here in the 1920s, you would have been able to use the electricity machine.
Mm-hmm.
This was another one of those penny arcade-style machines that was not only a sort of a test of strength, but if you sort of turn the handles to get a little bit of
–
you get a sort of a little bit of health, it would give you a nerve and muscle massage, which would basically mean it would taser you. You would pay to be tasered. But yeah, that was – look, the same way that Sears sold the little jiggly machine to help you lose weight, this was sort of something that was supposed to give you a nerve and muscle massage and make you healthier.
Oh, my. Well, an electric shock. And I remember growing up in California and going to Disneyland, and, yeah, they had those. And they had one where you could actually hold the two mm-hmm. metal things, and it would continue to build. So how long can you hold on?
I think they
on?
Still have one in Disneyland's mm-hmm. Penny Arcade.
Okay. But this one, unfortunately, I think is gutted because it no longer has the electrical cord. The mutoscope still has the electrical cord, and it works, and it's plugged into the... But I wish they had even more of those machines in here, because they're so much fun. But again, as we've been sitting here, we see people walking back and forth and not even paying attention, because again, they fit in with the time period. They're right. They seem right.
And so, Jim, as we start to make our way back to the opposite side of the lobby, mm-hmm. past the carousel, mm-hmm. again, it's the subtle little details, whether it's the mutoscopes or the artwork or the furniture, even things on the wall, right? Simple sort of artistic representations, whether they are authentic or created by Imagineering, helping to sort of complete the story. And even in the carpet, right? We're so used to seeing hidden Mickeys. There's also, you know, the little bit of Disney touch that's added too.
Of course, there's hidden Mickeys, and in the carpet, you'll find a series of little red circles around an oval. You'll find a hidden Mickey there. But if you look right to the side, you'll see little green pixie dust. And if you follow that little green pixie dust, it'll curve around. And by golly, who do you see at the end of that pixie dust?
Jim Corcus.
Ah, that's it. Absolutely. I'm full of pixie. Well, I'm full of something. I think pixie dust is what it is. Actually, you see Tinkerbell. And so Lou and I are just here to tell Steve Barrett to get his act together. You know, you've written enough hidden Mickey books. You need to start writing some books about where the hidden Donalds are, and the Tinkerbells and the Goofies and all of those. So Steve, you know, come on. I know you've got a couple of extra minutes during the day. Time for another book. And as Lou was pointing out, on the walls and some wonderful artwork. Again, some done by the Imagineers, where they're recreating some of the images of rides that were at Coney Island, specifically Luna Park. But you'll also see some framed pieces of artwork because, again, in the 20s and 30s, photography was not really that common, especially in terms of promoting a location. So sometimes you would hire an artist and they'd do little etchings or sketches or whatever so that people could see, oh, look how much fun everybody is having. We need to go there as well. And fortunately, as I said, one of the things that I really love they have here at the Boardwalk is they have these little white rectangles that have some information. So you can learn some more additional things because as much as Lou and I love to talk, we love the sound of our own voices. We can only get sometimes just the tip of the iceberg. And part of the fun is for you to come down and discover some of these things on your own and discover some of the things that we didn't have time to talk about because we are running out of time. So we've got to go into the lobby as well. And again, isn't this a magnificent lobby, Lou? Just look at this and the lighting overhead.
Well, I want to quickly go back to your point about the white placards because it's not something you find everywhere, right? We talk about it all the time that there is no great big book of Imagineering. There is no one place that you can go to, sort of the Bible of all the details. Mm-hmm. We do these things not because we're trying to explain every single thing, but we want to sort of give you the introduction and make you come and explore and learn more on your own. And that's what those placards help you do, but they don't exist everywhere. And I like the fact that they do exist here because whether you are the casual guest walking by or you are somebody really looking to sort of dig down into the layers of the onion, you are able to find something that's here all the time, not maybe the one cast member or a couple of cast members that know the deep details of the story. So I like the fact that they're here. I'd love to see more of those elsewhere, especially in places we see them in Animal Kingdom Lodge and a lobby there as well too. But yeah, going back into sort of the check-in area of the lobby, let's actually start over at the check-in desk itself because speaking of artwork, there again, you're not just finding representations of Coney Island, Luna Park, Atlantic City, but there's the Disney touch in there as well too because behind the check-in desk, you can find representations of the castles of Disneyland Paris.
Right, and those are actually right above the registration desk. And you see those frames there, and I've seen it described on websites and all that. Oh, yes, gold frames. They don't seem to realize. You just saw the carousel. You should see. Those are called rounding boards. Those would be on the exterior of a carousel. And again, traditionally, it would depict a pastoral setting. So that's why you're having this outdoor setting in these paintings here. And as Lou pointed out, as you go from left to right, you're going from Disneyland's castle to Disneyland Paris's castle to Walt Disney World's castle. And if they don't look exactly like the Disney castles, it's because the Disney Imagineers are trying to paint in the style of the 1920s, 1930s, and what those castles would really look like in a real-life setting. And for those who say, well, where's Hong Kong? Where's Tokyo Disneyland? Where's Hong Kong Disneyland? Well, Tokyo Disneyland's is the same as Walt Disney World, so you're going with that. But, you know, some of these parks didn't open, you know, when this opened. And, of course, in the center one, the Disneyland Paris one, if you look down to the right in the bushes, maybe you'll see a hidden Mickey, you know, buy Steve Barrett's book, go to his website, and you can double check, but that is there. And a magnificent open lobby here too. Love that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really is that visual magnet, that weenie, as Walt would call it, that draws people into the lobby, especially if maybe you're waiting to check in, is the plexiglass case that has a reproduction of the old Flip-Flap Railway. This roller coaster from Luna Park out in Coney Island, which is you look at it and you wonder if this sort of is a scale model. Is it a replica? This is actually, it's a model of something that existed there for a very short amount of time, but actually the coaster existed many years after.
Yes, and again, this is unlike the carousel. This is not a an authentic miniature from the time period. This was recreated, but it was recreated in that style. So when you see the figures and all of that, and the flip flap railway was what is usually considered as the first inverted coaster, because you're doing the loop. But it really isn't the loop that we're used to on coasters today. That I know very little about physics, or I'd be making a fortune today. I just know history. This really is a circle, 25 feet of going through a circle. And what happened is that creates an awful lot of G-forces. In fact, it creates about 12 G's. Now, to put that in perspective, because, you know, how many G's do you need? Mission Space generates about 2.5 G's for 45 seconds. If you were up in an airplane and doing acrobatics, you're up to about, 5 to 7 G's. If you're with the Blue Angels and doing at supersonic speed all of these amazing twists and turns, you're up to about 9, maybe to 11 G's. Here, you got 12 G's on this ride. You're having guests that are passing out. You're having guests that are having whiplash. So yes, it was at Luna Park at Coney Island for a year, and they thought, oh, we got to get rid of this. And so, of course, they got rid of it. And who picked it up? Atlantic City. Atlantic City picked it up. And so from 1902 to 1912, they were abusing guests on this. And you have to realize, too, that entertainment was different. So you might pay a dime to ride on this railway. They were also charging people a dime to stand at the bottom of the loop to see if anybody fell out. Because, again, you're not having safety bars. You're not having seat belts. And they might pass out. Money might fall out of people's pockets down there. So you pay a dime to see this. And there's also a photo up on the wall from 1910. So that's the flip-flap from Atlantic City. So you can see what that looked like. Fun was much different in the older days than it is.
The loop looked the first time I saw it. The first thing I thought about was my old Hot Wheels track as a kid. It's that same sort of thing that your car goes in, not what we see today in Rock and Roller Coaster or a traditional sort of loop. And you wonder how, first of all, how it got past the lawyers, but more importantly, how were people not getting flung out of this other than the centrifugal force keeping them in their seats.
And that was basically that and fear. That and fear, I know there are even some friends who ride some attractions at Disney, and we talk about, well, you should look up and look at the side. They have only seen the bottom of their feet on some rides because they are holding on so tightly. For that surprise. But again, this was just amazing for people because there was nothing else like it. And that was true of so many of the attractions, whether it was water chute rides or whatever. It was like, oh, my gosh, And once you were in an amusement park, it was in a temporary reality. You were in a different world than the one that you were used to. So rules were different and all of that. But, even with the Hot Wheels track you were talking about, that's more of an oval rather than a circle. And earlier you were also talking about, did you want it to look too carny on the boardwalk? They do have the Midway games there. One of the things I like about the hoops game is that the hoops are legitimate. They really are a circle. If you go to a carnival, one of the things they'll do is it'll be an oval hoop. And so you have to hit it the exact right spot. You can't just hit into the basket. It has to be the right spot of the basket for the ball to go through. So I will say, because I'm a carny. I used to work the Midway games at Six Flags Magic Mountain out in Valencia, California. And so I realized that if you stood on one side and you try and toss something, it won't go. But if you're on the side where the barker is and he tosses it, just because of the angle, just again, it goes right on, and it really does come down to physics and metaphysics and all this. I will tell you from personal experience, the games here on the Midway at the Boardwalk, absolutely accurate, absolutely fine. So at least they're not recreating that aspect of it. And thank heavens they're not recreating the aspect of the flip-flap railroad. I don't think we would even want to see that today.
Well, when you talk about the flip-flap, you used words like scary and fear and things you've never seen before. There's something else in the lobby that fits that exact description. And those are the two chairs on the opposite side of the fireplace. I will tell you, as someone who's not all that fond of clowns, that these are very unique. They almost look like chairs for children, but they're actually called nanny chairs. They're something that came from the old sort of 18th, 19th century carousels in Europe. And they, if a parent wanted to ride, or maybe they didn't want to sort of hop up in their dress onto a moving horse, they could sit in one of these chairs that wouldn't move along the carousel. I can tell you, though, Jim Corcus, I'm sure I'm not the only guy who thinks they're a little bit scary. The reproductions, they were cast from the originals, hand-painted. They're beautiful in terms of the hand carving, the painting, but the faces are a little bit creepy.
Well, and see, there you go again with the you know, how an interpretation is better. Just because something existed at that time doesn't mean it's pleasant. Doesn't mean you want to experience it. And yes, these were cast from original chairs from 1889. And no, you won't find that on the signage here. I think they just say 1800s on the signage. So that's why you should still always listen to a Lou Mangiello podcast, because you're getting more. And yes, it's gold leaf, and yes, they are tremendously scary. They almost look like screaming little kids, you know, that you're sitting on. And yes, as Lou pointed out, they were often used on a carousel, and many people believe that this is what sparked the chariots on a carousel, which were those benches where people could sit. But the nanny chairs were also used so that people could sit when kids were they were mobile, because they're chairs, you can pick them up and do. So you could sit next to some other ride that only a kid could be on. And again, they were called nanny chairs because primarily it was the nannies who were taking care of the kids, not the parents. And one little fun thing that Lou and I had fun with as we were looking at these earlier this morning, and so this is how you can show off to your friends and family, because you listen to these podcasts so that you can be the expert for, you know, the Disney expert for your friends and family. And that's fine, because it's just important to pass along the stories. Nobody says, oh, did you hear that from Lou and Jim? Pull the chair a little away from the wall and look on the back, because the Imagineers, and heaven only knows what was going through their minds, they put their names on the chair. So if you pull away one of the chairs, it'll say Todd, and the other chair will say Paul. Those were the two Imagineers who worked on recasting and hand painting these. But yes, they are tremendously scary, but yes, they are historic. But they're certainly a conversation starter. And I notice, you know, a lot of people in the lobby, and they're sitting in chairs. Nobody comes and sits
Nobody sits right there. It almost is like, keep away from the fireplace, and these are the two minions that we have guarding the threshold. I want to sort of finish off with the last detail and really sort of bring it full circle for me, because one of the other conversation pieces in there, which is just sort of out of arm's length, is something that I remember going to visit as a child, not in Atlantic City, but nearby in the town of Margate, and it's Lucy. And Lucy isn't a girl, because I didn't date very much back then, but Lucy is an elephant, and not a real elephant, but a giant wood elephant that was sort of used as a promotional tool for to sell real estate and things like that. Let's talk a little about Lucy and her sister in Coney Island.
Yeah, actually, she has two sisters, but that's it. Yes, right over the fireplace, you'll see a model of an elephant, and this is Lucy, and the trunk is in the bucket. But here's something you probably never even occurred to you, Lou, and this can be for listeners too. When you stand there and you look at that model and you go, yes, this is Lucy the elephant, there's something immediately you should say, this is entirely wrong. It's just like Donald Duck is entirely wrong, because Duck is a female name. For male, it's a Drake, so it should be Donald Drake instead of Donald Duck. So you're taking a look at Lucy, and I can see you tipping your head, Lou, like, you know, like when I talk to a dog, and, you know, yes, we're not going out. What? Tipping the head and all of this. This is Lucy. This is a girl.
She's a male elephant.
Has tusks. Male elephant. And by the size of the ears, you can also tell it's an Asian elephant. Well, believe it or not, there was this 25-year-old guy by the name of James Lafferty, and he really wanted to get into real estate, but he thought, you know, if I've got to build something iconic to catch people's attention in order to sell real estate. So working with an architect, he came up with a design to build an animal-shaped building. And in fact, this was so unique, had never been done before. We talk about California crazy architecture at Disney Hollywood. This had never been done before. So he went and he actually got a patent. So only he was allowed to build animal-shaped buildings for 17 years. So he built Lucy. Lucy was about 65 feet tall. And believe it or not, it is so tall it can be seen 8 miles out to sea. So originally it was a place where people would come and be sold real estate in the nearby area, because when Lucy was built, you can see early pictures. There's nothing around there. And then over the years, she was used for a variety of things. She was short-lived as a hotel, as a private residence, as a souvenir shop. At one time, believe it or not, into the 20s, she was a tavern. She sold beer, and she was one of the last beer taverns to close down when Prohibition came to effect, and she immediately started serving beer again when Prohibition was repealed. It inspired she was so popular, so iconic, people would want to take pictures, even to this day. People get married in there. People get people propose in there, whatever.
Right, she's still there.
Yeah, she survived Hurricane Sandy. The water apparently came up to her toenails, but that was about it. So the next one that Lafferty built was in Coney Island, and this was called the Elephant Colossus, or the Colossal Elephant, and this was 125 feet tall. But again, this is built out of wood with tin sheeting, and at Coney Island, as happened with a lot of the Coney Island theme parks, it caught fire, burned down, they did an illustration on the cover of a newspaper, you know, beloved icon, you know, burns to death over that. And then there was a third called Taste of Asia, that was smaller than Lucy, and that was over in Cape May. Now, Lucy, of course, as Lou was telling you, was Margate, New Jersey. Margate was not always called Margate. It was called South Atlantic City. So that's it's right there, Atlantic City. So you went to the boardwalk and you went over and you went to see Lucy. And Lou and I have been debating, because, you know, people tell you things and you want to check them out. You know, it's not that they're necessarily wrong, but you want to check them out. And so somebody had said to me, that's Mary Poppins up there in the lighted window. And I just don't buy that as a Mary Poppins reference. The Tinkerbell reference, very clear. Mary Poppins, I just don't know.
Yeah, but we looked at it, and yeah. you can see how somebody might want to interpret that, but to me it looks like a woman in sort of one of the large hats. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the artwork here, you'll see people strolling on the boardwalk. They got, you know, when you went out, you got dressed not to go to the beach, but to sort of stroll and to see and be seen on the boardwalk. That is sort of the hat that I sort of imagine that a woman would have worn. So, and Mary Poppins just, she doesn't fit. She doesn't fit into the story of, she would, I don't, from what I saw, she did not ever visit Atlantic City or Margate. And then again, when the casinos came, you never know.
Well, you know, even Mary Poppins, what happens in Atlantic City stays in Atlantic City. Even Mary Poppins needs some fun every now and then. And in the howdah, which is the thing on top of the elephant, supposedly there's a hidden Mickey up there if you look. But again, I'm not a huge hidden Mickey fan, but I know many of you are, and good for you. And if that adds to your enjoyment of Disney, more power to you.
Absolutely. So, Jim, you know, again, we covered a lot in a relatively small space. We covered a lot of incredible details that, again, not just set the stage for this 3D play that we're all a part of, but really helped to tell a story of a real place in American history, a snapshot in time, that picture postcard. And I think the boardwalk is one of the finest examples. And we're going to have to take some time to visit some of the other resorts and look at their hidden treasures and stories and details. I will tell you that where we're sitting right here in the Bellevue Lounge is one of my favorite places, not just at the resort, but in all of Walt Disney World. I invite people to come down and look and listen and learn on their own. Tell us, too, in the comment section. Come to this week's show notes. Come in the comment section. Tell us what you enjoy most about Disney's Boardwalk Resort. Also, tell us what you enjoy most about Jim Corcus. Is it Who's Afraid of Song of the South? Is it the revised Vault of Walt? I'm going to put links to both of those where you can purchase them on in print format or on Kindle format directly from Amazon in this week's show notes. And, of course, Jim, you know I love having you on. I've got to have you back because this is always a blast, sort of peeling back the layers of the onion.
It's always fun with you, Lou. And again, it's always fun sharing this information with your listeners. And I will tell you that both Lou and I just get a big smile on our face when you come up to us and say, hey, you know, we love hearing you on the podcast, and we love learning about these things. And please make sure you go out and share those stories with others, because as Lou keeps pointing out, there is no big book of Imagineering. I wish there was. A lot of these stories, a lot of this information is getting lost or is getting confused and twisted around. And so it's up to us to keep the stories alive. And yeah, I hope we'll get a chance to talk more about Boardwalk, because there's so many stories to tell about Luna Park and even some of those shops down on the boardwalk itself. And thanks for plugging Who's Afraid of the Song of the South and the revised Vault of Walt. I thank you for that. All of you out there, thanks for keeping the magic alive, and keep listening to WDW Radio.
We'll come back, we'll get a Surrey bike, and we'll explore the outside of the boardwalk resort. Jim, thanks again. It's time for our Walt Disney World Trivia Question of the Week, where I ask you to challenge yourself to see how well you know your Disney details, history, trivia, or maybe I'll play a random sound clip or quote a line from a show or an attraction, ask you to identify where in Walt Disney World you may have heard it. We'll select one winner randomly from all the correct entries to win a Disney prize package. But before we get to this week's question, let's go back to last week, review our question and the answer, and select our winner. So last week, we rode aboard my Walt Disney World Wayback Machine, went back in time to 1993, looking at Walt Disney World's past and changes, and I asked you to visit Tomorrowland and name two attractions that once occupied the space where Buzz Lightyear's Space Ranger Spin currently resides. And once again, you guys are awesome, because of the few hundred of you that entered, all of you got this correct. Again, I was looking for anything from if you had wings to if you could fly, Delta Dream Flight, or just Dream Flight, or Take Flight.
And those attractions go back to 1972, when the first attraction in that space, If You Had Wings, opened. It was sponsored by Eastern Airlines, ran from about 15 years until June of 1987, when the sponsorship ended and the ride was renamed If You Could Fly. That attraction, which is pretty much the same as If You Had Wings, except without all the Eastern references, closed in January 1989, just 6 months later. A new attraction opened, completely rethemed, called Delta Dreamflight, obviously sponsored by Delta Airlines. In January 1996, that was renamed Dreamflight after Delta pulled their sponsorship, and it remained that way until June of that year, when it closed down, reopened once again, this time as Take Flight. That attraction closed in January 1998 and eventually reopened again as Buzz Lightyear's Space Ranger Spin 10 months later. Thank you again to all of you who played. Congratulations to each and every one of you that got that correct. Gold star to some of you who named each and every one of the attractions. You got no bonus points, but kudos to you. You know your Disney World history. Again, you were playing for all six of my audio walking tours of the Magic Kingdom and Walt Disney World, a WDW Radio luggage tag and a button, and a signed copy of Walt Disney World Trivia Book, Volume 2. And this week's winner is Wendy Valadaria. So, Wendy, congratulations. Thank you again for playing. If you played last week and didn't win, I appreciate you entering, but don't worry, because here's your next opportunity to enter in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So as long as we're talking about Disney's boardwalk resorts, one of my favorite features there is the Luna Park pool area. So here's your question. Tell me, what is the name of the water slide at Disney's boardwalk resort? You'll have until Sunday, February 3rd at 11:59 p.m. to email your answers to contest@wdwradio.com. We'll be playing again for all the audio tours, a luggage tag, button, a mystery pin from New Fantasyland. So good luck and have fun. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks again for taking the time and tuning in this and every week. Please make sure you come by the website over at wdwradio.com. Check out our blog, videos, subscribe to our newsletter, download the free WDW Radio app, and lots more. Be sure and also join us Wednesday night, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, for our live video broadcast and chat, where you can be part of the discussion where we talk about this week's Walt Disney World news over at wdwradiolive.com. You can email me with a question at lou@wdwradio.com or call the voicemail, be heard on the air, 407-900-9391. You can follow me on Twitter. I am @LouMangello, and come and like the page, facebook.com/WDW Radio. While you're on the site, be sure and check out the events page and tune in Saturday, February 9th for our 6th anniversary show. Go by the blog, vote, and you can help determine what we do during our 6-hour adventure in Epcot. And then come by if you're going to be in the parks to the meet of the month, Saturday, February 9th, 4 o'clock at the Electric Umbrella in Epcot. We'll have a lot of surprises, a mystery will be revealed, information about our fantasy cruise, some dates about our family museum, and lots more. You can also find out more by visiting wdwradio.com/6year, the number 6, YEAR. Quick thanks to my partners and sponsors, MouseFan Travel. It's who I use, it's who I highly recommend, whether you're going to Disney World, Disneyland, Adventures by Disney, Disney Cruise Line, or anywhere in the world. Becky and her team of agents not only give you the best possible prices, all available discounts, even if they come up after you book, but it's a level of personal service that they give you that is their hallmark. Check them out over at mousefantravel.com when you're coming down to Walt Disney World. And when you're coming down to Walt Disney World, maybe you want something a little bit bigger, multiple master bedrooms for you, grandma, grandpa, other extended family, and more. The allstarvacationhomes.com has more than 150 homes with up to 9 bedrooms, just a couple of miles away from Walt Disney World. Again, you can find them at allstarvacationhomes.com. And if you want some Disney magic delivered right to your door or to your iPad or Amazon Kindle device, Celebrations Magazine is available over at celebrationspress.com, as well as in the Apple App Store. It's a bi-monthly magazine celebrating all the magic of the Disney parks, the films, and much more. Again, you can find out more information over at celebrationspress.com. And as always, my friends, and you are my friends, whether we have met yet or not, all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word. Let others know about it. Tweet out that you're listening. Share links to your favorite episodes, or come by and comment over on Facebook. And please rate and review the show and the app over on iTunes. Very helpful. Very, very much appreciated. And finally, and most importantly, I want to thank each and every one of you for taking the time to tune in each and every week and for allowing me to share my passion for Disney with you through this show and so many other ways. Every day and your friendship is a gift. And I want you to remember that life is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Go slow and steady towards what your goals are and enjoy every step of the journey along the way. Hope you guys have a great week this week. So until next time, see ya.
Hey, Lou, this is Kira.
And Hector.
From California. We're calling right now from Germany and Epcot. We're on our first day of a six-day vacation, and it's all thanks to you and the unofficial guides. You both have made our vacation possible. We're really, really excited. And this is Hector's first visit, so he's experiencing everything for the first time, which is just the best.
Right. All the food you recommended.
Oh, yeah. Everywhere we go, I say, oh, Lou said this. The school bread was awesome. We're sharing a bratwurst right now, and it's great. So thanks for everything, Lou. Keep them coming, and see ya.
Hi, Lou. This is Heather. I am a new listener. I've been listening for about a month now. I have a new iPhone that I've been listening to your show on, and I listen while I cook dinner every night. And when there's a lull in the day, I listen to the show, and sometimes I get so hooked I crank up the volume on my iPhone and I listen in the shower because I can't wait 10 minutes to hear the end of the show I've been listening to. And I just want to tell you thank you for telling the listeners that you love us and that we're part of your family and for being so positive and not too critical. I just don't think people hear that kind of positive energy enough these days, and I really appreciate that. And I love the histories you share and the tips, the news, the funny and informative guests you have, and the overall charm of the show, and that it's clean entertainment. I really appreciate that I can have my kids running in and out of the room, and I'm not afraid of what they're going to hear on your show. And I just want to say, hey, hopefully someday I'll see you in the park. We don't live close, but if we're ever coming your way, we'll try and make it to see you. Thanks, Lou. Take care.
You've got a friend.